all right, here we go. This is Wild West Filmmaking. We have a special guest who is actually our first guest, Michael Paraskevas. How are
Thanks
you?
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Still yeah, we're, yeah, it's a we're that's the thing about it's the beauty of this, and it's also the curse. If you're on the early receiving time, sometimes it can be a little sketch, or opposite. If you do it in the evening, you're all like jazzed up and the people are ready to crash out.
I'm an early riser. So
are you really?
Yeah. I learned that was one of the big things I learned during COVID is just like get up early and just get it done. Cause it's I can't work, or try not to.
So you found this out during COVID?
Yeah. I think maybe like a little before COVID, but then once I was like obviously home all the time and, you know, stuck at my desk, you know, I would like get up really early, go on a walk. And I find I like to work before like all the emails and Slack messages start coming in and just have at least a couple hours early in the day to just, you know, just be with myself, you know, creatively and just find so much more peace in that way. And then if I start the day well, then it's like you can just kind of ride that wave.
Yeah.
I used to like, you know, procrastinate and like wait and then like start working late at night, but then you'd be up, you know, doing all nighters and stuff. And I was just like, this is not sustainable.
So. Yeah. That's, you know, it's wild because we're all different. I was going to ask you that of like your method and we can get into that. So, you know, some people believe or think, or it could be true. It could be it's different for individuals. It's different for me, especially as I've grown older. But like, you know, I think it was Bob Dylan who said there was on his first album, there was like two or three songs that asked like, I mean, was this a long process of this song? He said, no. One night he opened up the windows over in Greenwich Village. And he said the song flew into the window because everyone else was sleeping. And he said he just wrote it. It came to him. I think that has a lot to do with youth. Probably at that time, substances. There's freedom. That's something that people don't really, that I struggle with that no one really talked about, which was the creative process being easier when I was, you know, when I was 19, 20, 21, and 22, I didn't have any responsibilities as in just trying to not die, basically, you know, and navigate life. And I think out of that, you're this super open vessel, right? And you're not worried about 401ks. You're not worrying about children, just different things, or, you know, a 9-to-5 or promotions, or there's just things that we just, you know, add on to our, I mean, even like a Netflix bill, right? You just keep adding these little things that I think feel like weigh you down. And it's just growing up. It's life. It's not, you can't escape those things, but there is a freedom sometimes, I think. Yeah. And I think, if you can carve, that's why you have to carve out the time. It was Quentin Tarantino who said he used to write, you know, him and Paul Thomas Anderson, they're known for partying and staying up super late and going on benders and then writing, right? Subconsciously writing. Well, obviously, PTA is totally different now. And Quentin says that he wakes up early in the morning. He writes from 8 to 11. He has lunch, tea. He gets in the pool and hangs out in the pool, hangs out with his family. And then they have dinner and he watches movies. And the next day he wakes up a little bit earlier and reads it. And so it's a routine of, and he says he writes, I feel like his stuff's enhanced in a way. I mean, there's nothing, you can't compare anything to Boogie Nights, but like it's enhanced. I mean, have you ever felt like for you, was there ever times when it was easier for you to write in the midnight hours, keeping the window open?
Yeah, I mean, I think like you said, like when I was younger and like, I was like in college, like, you know, and stuff like that, where it's, you have a whole, like you go to the football game, then you go straight to the, you know, go straight to the computer lab and keep working till 3 a.m. And I think, you know, there's definitely a certain like energy and endurance that you need for that. And I know some people too, like that I know out here, like who are older than me, like they still, you know, like those midnight hours. And I think it's sort of different for everyone and you kind of have to find what works for you. And I read like this really good book called Rest, and it talks sort of examines all these famous like thinkers, scientists, artists, creatives, like people, politicians, like throughout history, in all these different cultures. And it's sort of, it looks at like what their, you know, schedules are like, their routines. And a lot of them are like Tarantino's, where like they only work, you know, deep focus for a couple hours a day, and then they go off and do other things. And like, you're still like, you're filling your soul. You're still, your brain is still working, like when you sleep, like, and so there's all these different, I guess, like strategies or things that you can do to sort of optimize that. And I always thought that was really fascinating, because it's sort of the opposite of what we're taught in this country and sort of the work culture that's ingrained in here. And, but it's nice, I guess, as an independent artist, we have a little more freedom in that regard to sort of discover what works for us. And, I feel like I've the past few years just really trying to like hone in on that process and to work more efficiently, or to, work in a way where you don't dread it. And I know that's, you know, when you're working on a project like that, like a, with any sort of deadline, like it always, there's all these other external pressures. And so it's, you know, how do you keep yourself, how do you keep momentum going? How do you keep the joy and, you know, preserve all of that?
Yeah. It's like the long game, right? It's like trying to figure out how to still be creative. I mean, I'm always inspired. Like, you know, I read Flea's new book or his autobiography, and just his life of like that, I mean, destructive lifestyle that they had, but they were the Chili Peppers and it sort of worked. It was like this, I can't imagine being around them when in their prime, when they were just whacked out and crazy and that energy, but he still has it. He still has that twinkle in his eye, but he takes care of himself. You know, he does lots of yoga and plays basketball and doesn't party. And, you know, he's, I mean, money helps, though, you can have a lifestyle like that. I think that's sort of, if you don't make it big early on and you don't get that big paycheck, you really have to like stop for a second and be like, okay, what's the long game here? And how do I still stay sharp, creative, loose, right? And, but still take care of myself. And it's almost like I went through a really, after I did, because This World Won't Break was, I mean, you know, that dang near killed me. Because I was like living, I was doing everything. I was still like, it was called Whiskey Beard Films. And I owned up to that, like late night lifestyle of like shooting and going to shows. And I remember thinking like, oh, I didn't want to make another movie because of how I physically felt and mentally felt. I was fried. And I was like, oh, I don't want to make another movie. And I realized, no, I just don't want to make another movie like that. Yeah. You know? It's so hard. It's like on El Tanto Per Cristo, it's like, I've never been more like taking care of myself. I didn't have one drop of anything during the pre-production and then like the production of the film and part of post-production. And I can't imagine even having like a glass of wine, because I was sleeping like 2 hours a day, but I would wake up and I was just on fire. And I became like, I have a very addictive personality when it comes to anything in life. And I became like so addicted to having that clear, sharp mind, and it served me so well, and it does serve well. And I realized, oh, there's more power in this, in rest and taking care of yourself. And it's not about, you know, any type of substance or any type of like sleep deprivation, or, you know, there's no medal of honor for that. And yeah. I had to let it go. And it felt like, I felt exposed. I felt insecure a little bit, but I think just like, you know, working with everybody else was on the same page as well. And, you know, and you were dialed in. We all had to be dialed in on El Tanto Per Cristo. And, you know, we're talking today because today is the day that the first single is released. Mm-hmm. It's out into the world. We've, you know, it feels like, you know, and I want to get into this of how you feel in the process. You know, we're talking about, you know, being able to carry on and plow through. Like, this is something that we had talked about, you know, 3 years ago. The movie was shot literally 2 years ago this month. And then we go into the, you know, the Quickest Park shooting. We shot for 14 days and it's taken us 2 years for this single to come out because of the release of the film. How do you as a composer, as a creative, you know, you're able to plan, you're able to write, conduct, do all these things, and then you have other projects in the meantime. How do you keep that flame going from idea to today? And the album's not out today. It's, you know, the whole entire album comes out October 6th, and it's the world premiere of El Tanto Pa' Cristo. And it's wild because I heard this thing when you posted everything this morning, and I was looking at stuff, and it just gave me chills. And it's that picture that I'm so proud of, that shot that Hutch Crane had did at the very end of the film. And I was like, oh, I wish we could hold on that shot longer, but the film doesn't need it. Yeah, but now we have it forever. Yeah. And so, yes, I just, if you don't mind, like, this is Wild West filmmaking. I want people to, you know, we peel the curtain back a little bit of, you were coming off of and still in Agatha All Along and some other projects. How do you balance that? How do you keep the fire going? And are you still excited today as you were when you first saw a rough cut?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I think for me, keeping the fire going is, honestly, it comes relatively easy. And I think, especially, you know, just the way, you know, projects sort of are sequenced, where I think for me, a big thing that I, you know, try to focus on is like working on things that are different than what I've worked on before. And I love, like, you know, doing so many different genres and styles and different types of story making. And I think that's what's really special about this, you know, industry and this, you know, this world that we live in, is there's so many ways to express being human and so many ways to share stories. And so I think it was, you know, it was interesting going, you know, from this very intense, like, studio environment. And, you know, we have these Zoom calls with a bunch of people on them. And there's, you know, there's all these, you know, different layers of things that you're, you know, trying to coordinate that you can make it really challenging. And the timeline is really crazy. And then basically had like a month to, like, you know, take a break. And then, but even then I was like already kind of overlapping and diving in with El Tanto. And it's, you know, such a different shift where if even though we're, you know, not even in the same time zone, that, you know, it feels more intimate, and it's sort of, you try to find that sense of collaboration even on the bigger projects. But I think searching for that intimacy and so the creative synergy. And I think, you know, since we've worked before and like, and since we've been talking about, you know, El Tanto for even longer, I think that it was such an easy transition to sort of get into that. And I think it was kind of nice because we coming off this momentum from Agatha, and just like, as soon as I started writing, it was just like, it was just coming out. And it wasn't, you know, sometimes when you start a project, you sort of get stuck in the beginning and you're sort of unsure of where to go or what you're looking for. And I think, you know, for us, we've like had this dialogue, we had, you know, you'd show me, you know, scenes here and there, seen parts of the script. And like, so it's even like, if I'm not actively writing music, it's just been sitting in the back of my mind. And we've been listening to like Orthodox Chant and like other, you know, musical references. And so I think, yeah, it was kind of, it's like once we got going on it, then it felt very natural. And I think, you know, it's all about allowing ourselves, our creativity, our bodies just to like open up to that, you know, the window, like Bob Dylan, and just let that flow through. But it's, you can't just like expect it to happen. You have to sort of prepare for that. And I think but once it does, then that's what makes it so, you know, invigorating. And I think whenever a project like reveals itself to you, I think there's something like really special on that.
Yeah. Maybe you can walk us through, I know it's probably different every time that you compose something or write something, but what is, once again, this is Wild West filmmaking. There's probably some composers or people who want to make music to film. What is the process for you? Like, you know, obviously there's some go by stuff. Do you want a lot of go by? Do you not want a lot of go by when you sit down? Because in El Tanto, for example, I mean, we have Simitron. If a lot of people don't know what a Simitron is, it's a large piece of wood that monks would hammer and bang on to replicate this, you know, there we go. Yeah. If you're watching this, there you go.
well.
That's the that's amazing.
Yeah.
So you're incorporating that, you're incorporating banjo, slide guitar, actual hymns from the Orthodox Church that you play on. So when you're if there's no music, there's nothing, what do you do? Are you the kind of person who does guitar, piano? I would just like to know your process of how, is it different each scene, or is it always kind of a, because they're all blank and you got to put something there. How does that, because it's mesmerizing to me.
Yeah, I'd say the process kind of for each story, kind of, you have to sort of figure out where to start. And, you know, for something like this, where we talked about there's certain colors and certain instruments and sounds that, you know, really build up this world. And so for me, it was like, I'm going to go and just like, we're going to record like those instruments and, you know, have a guitarist just like, you know, record different like textures and sounds. And, you know, that gets some of the music gets a little into like these sort of gothic horror elements. Mm. And so that's something like, you know, you can't really like mock up on a computer. You have to actually go and record that. And so we just, you know, create these like, you know, giant, I always think of it as like, you're like dump the Lego bin out on the floor and you just have all the pieces there, but you can see them. And then you sort of just start combining them and picking ones and put them together. And I think that's like such a fun part at the beginning, is like, you're just building your toolkit. And then like with the Cimatron, like that was one where I was like, I don't, like, this would be a really cool idea, but I'm like, I don't know how we're going to do this. Like, I don't know where to find one. And I was like looking online and it's hard to like really find much info. And like, short of like going to a monastery in Greece or something, I'm like, I don't know what to do. But then I stumbled across, there's this artist in of all places at the Nasher Museum in, is it Dallas or Fort Worth?
Dallas, yeah, Nashers in downtown Dallas, yeah.
Yeah, I saw this, like, there was literally the year, probably while you were filming, like, this artist, Robert Barsamian, had built, like, a big Cimatron for this exhibit that he did there. And I found he worked with this musician, Kayla Liptak, who was at UNT at the time, and she performed as part of this, you know, exhibit. And so I reached out to her and I was like, hey, do you still have access to it? And sure enough, she did. And so, you know, even though I was still here, we were able to connect, and then she was able to go and record just a bunch of, you know, little snippets. And
I didn't know that. I never knew that. Yeah. Oh my gosh. So, so the Cimatron that you hear in the movie, in the soundtrack and score, I thought it was somebody you knew out in Los Angeles like a church there, like an Orthodox Greek church. So you found out about it at the Nasher Museum, and the girl was a student at UNT.
Yeah.
And then you reached out, she records it, and that's what we're hearing on the score. Oh my goodness.
Meant to be. And
yeah. And this film is like, yeah.
Of all places, like
I feel like this entire film really is, I mean, down to the random goat that's in my movie, there was a guy who was mute and deaf and he had a goat farm, and I got to pick out a goat because the white albino armadillo that I had cast in a scene had passed away, and we were scrambling and there wasn't cell phone service, and I saw this guy. So it's just like, that's the beauty of being open, being ready, prepared, and you have to strike. And that's what luck really is. People talk about luck, and it was always growing up, luck meant like somebody that was lazy, that scratched off a ticket. But really, luck is like doing your work, being prepared. And when that little opening opens up in the sky, the lightning bolt can strike through it. And, you know, it's chance, it's timing. Is there anything else? This is great. I want to just talk more about this. Is there any other crazy, or is everybody local that you used And how do you know that's the right person? Or is it just like, sometimes it's just the only person, you know?
Yeah. It was actually pretty spread out. And honestly, come to think of it, I think a lot of the musicians, like, we recorded remotely or, you know, away from LA. And I think it's people I've built relationships with. And so, like, the guitarist, or one of the guitarists, Joe Ayoub, who did, like, the acoustic stuff, like, he, you know, used to be out here and now he's in New York, you know, plays on the Kelly Clarkson show and like a longtime collaborator. And so we, you know, it's very easy for me to hit him up and like, hey, like, we're looking for these sort of things. Like, can you like send that over? And we kind of like hopped on a Zoom call and sort of like talked through it as he's recording. And so that was fun. And then, you know, I think it's kind of similar, I think, with a lot of people where it's sort of ideas of what we're looking for, and sort of like, but like, do your thing. And I'm always interested in hearing, like, you know, what musicians like that, they know their instrument better than like anyone, and like, what are cool ideas or textures that, you know, they have in their arsenal, and sort of this back and forth. And then, like, I did have violinist Lauren Elizabeth Baba. She came over. And like, for her stuff, like, a lot of it was more like written out. And so it's that, you know, it's very specific sort of what we're, you
but
know,
you trying had to written do. Out for her.
Yeah.
Like sheet music. Okay.
Yeah. So that's kind of, since we record that more towards the end of the process, cause it's, mm-hmm. it's also, it's like, it's easier, to, you know, like, mock up like fake violin, mm-hmm. At least for sort of this, some of the stuff that we're doing. But knowing that, like, you know, she's gonna, you know, and she was on tour with Japanese Breakfast at the time. And it was like, I was like, I hope you're in town, like, when we need to record. And thankfully she was, cause she's amazing.
Yeah, it's so wild because, like, I mean, you would send like that, you would send some stuff that I think you had played on the keyboard that was violin. And, you know, we're finding the tempo and the sound and the mood. And it's so wild because sometimes that does work, right? Like, you know, listening to some computer music and like some Spike Jonze films or whatever, it's like, you can only imagine if it had an actual score, it wouldn't. It's knowing when to have real instruments and when to not. And on this, whenever she plays on there, it's just, even though it's the same tone, it's the same note, it's just, it feels more raw and alive because the film is very much chest open, right? It's a very raw look inside of, because they're in this monastery, they're in their cassocks, they're in their cells, so they're kind of like closing themselves off, but yet they're so vulnerable. And I think that when you hear these real instruments, like even like the Cimatron, just the one pop, it gives you so much emotion. Whenever you do that, do you know when it can be electronic and when it can be real? I mean, is that like an instinct right off the bat? And sometimes it's just, you know, it's funding, it's having the right being able to pay people. And so are there a lot of times where it's like, it's because of money that it just needs to be that way and you can't do a you know, a real person? Or is it because of the tone? Or is it?
I think it's 99% of it, it's usually the budget will help sort of dictate what you do. But even on like smaller budgets and like short films and stuff, if the story needs like a live musician, then I will do anything and everything I can to make that happen. Cause I think it's, again, there's just like a certain magic that, you know, other artists bring. And I think that's what's so special about filmmaking, is it's just this like huge collaboration between all these, you know, geniuses in their different fields that come together and somehow like make a story. And so I think that's something that I personally like just try to, you know, pursue as much as possible. And even if it's like, there's no budget, but like, you know, can I buy you lunch? Or like, I know like on the next one where it's a bigger budget, like you'll get paid like real good. And
for sure.
Or like, is there stuff I can record myself and like, you know, play some instruments. And so I think there's, each project sort of kind of guides you like what that is. Cause also like, if it's, you know, a 4-minute short film, like, are you going to is a story really going to need like a big orchestra? Like, that's not, you kind of have to find, like, chances are it's probably going to need something smaller and more intimate, and maybe that is more practical in a recording sense anyway. And so I think it's, it just really depends. And I think, you know, technology is so crazy now where you can make things sound pretty real, but you can still tell when an actual human is performing it, because it's just, there's a soul to it that, you know, doesn't exist with the programming. But then, like, there are certain cases where sometimes it is easier just to keep the samples. And, but I think it really varies sort of the type of thing we're doing. Like pianos, I don't think we have any piano in this, but like piano samples generally sound pretty good. So if it's like, actually on This World Won't Break, there were a couple cues where like we just kept the samples as it was. And like, there's not a reason to go book a studio and like do all this for, you know, 2 minutes of piano that's just like melody or something. And so it just depends on the case, but as much as I can, like, yeah, try to work with real musicians.
Yeah. And speaking of like having a soul and being connected with something that's live, you know, on this one, we got a chance to work with the Polyphonic Spree Choir, who have all been around, you know, they've been in the band since it first started in 26 years. And there was something that was so important about having that sound. I think maybe just because I've just always known it. It's been something so familiar to me, but it encapsulates. Is that a right word? I don't know. Maybe it's too early for me in Dallas, but it, you know, it summed up what I wanted the film to feel like, which is angelic, heavenly, and also there's those moments with Rosemary, like childlike, right? It, I feel like whenever they sing it, it referenced, you know, Rosemary and the end of the film with Rosemary. And so what was that like? And I was kind of in and out on that whole process. You and Andrew, who's you've worked with, and you guys are phenomenal together. You guys came to Dallas, and we set up a recording studio with John Pedigo. And yeah, just, you want to walk us through that process and how that works when people hear the film?
Yeah. And thank you. Yeah, shout out to Andrew Simakai. You know, really helped, you know, on my team, just keep everything, you know, going. And yeah, coordinating all that, but it is a lot. I think also, you know, with Jessica and as sort of like the spearheading it as well. And I think it was another instance of like, you know, everyone, all the, you know, the choir members are all sort of scattered about, and we had to sort of pinpoint the, like, this one chance to we're all together in the same room. And
Haley's,
I think
it, Haley's Comet, yeah.
Yeah, but we found it and it worked. And I think it was so much fun. Like, you know, also just being from Dallas, you know, go back home, and my parents were able to come for the recording session as well. And yeah, I think it was just like a really, you know, special, energetic, you know, thing. And we talked a lot about, you know, how their voices like sound like waves, these ocean waves. Now it's like a recurring motif throughout the film, and that there's something, like you said, angelic and spiritual and sort of ethereal to it. And it was really cool, because it's, you know, it had five singers, but all sort of sound like one embodied voice. And I think that, you know, that's just, I think also, I guess personally as well, like, I listened to Polyphonic Spree like when I was younger, and like they came and performed at my high school at one point. And here we are years later, like never knew like our paths would cross again in the same way. And I just think there's all these like little cosmic things that are like, oh yeah, I guess that's, this is how it's meant to be. And I think it was, yeah, just really special, you know, just working with them, and really added just so much, you know, magic to the score and to these moments. And I think really helps uplift it. And I think it was just such a like such an important part of the story. And I think, you know, it's something that we had talked about like very early on, of like, we're gonna find a way to work this in. And like, it's, we kind of became like this, you know, this other character and representing, you know, these, you know, without revealing anything about the story, but just representing like certain moments and certain you know, parts of the story that I think just really, really sublime. And so,
yeah, it's, you know, and it's so important to me, because as a storyteller, a filmmaker, a lot of filmmakers can get caught up in the trap of, a lot of this has to do with from the top, you know, right? Production, they're going to give you money. They want it to look like Fast and the Furious, or they want it to feel like this. They want it to feel like, so you're already kind of have been painted in a corner. And so the great thing about independent film and having someone professional and talented like you on an independent film is, you know, from the beginning, I was like, there's never been a film made about orthodoxy in America that's a narrative feature that's just imagination and mystery and wonder. There's been documentaries and stuff. And also, there hasn't been anything in Texas. And the monastery here in Kemp, Texas, which is like an hour from Dallas, has two nuns in it right now. A lot of people think of monasteries like Mount Athos, and there's hundreds and hundreds and thousands of monks all over. And, you know, this was my world. It's driving all the way out there, and it's just nature. There's, you know, there's cows and stuff from the next door neighbor. And then the music was, you know, banjo music. A lot of my friends are in bands, and they play the banjo, and that's the sound you hear around here. And then I've been involved with the Polyphonic Spree for so long. And so I really hope, and I do believe, that people are going to walk away watching and hearing something that they've never experienced before, because how could you have? It's our experience. And just the fact that we have the Polyphonic Spree Choir, Matthew Posey improvising a banjo song, and then all the talented musicians you have and brought in, and you and your dad writing an original piece. There's just so much. We could probably do 2 hours of just talking about just the soundtrack. And what was that like for you? Was that always an idea to have your dad and you write something original? Is it one of those lightning bolt things that was just, it happened because of what the film needed in that certain point?
Yeah. No, that was very much a lightning bolt thing. Mm. And it was interesting, because it actually came from, you know, I had gone back to Dallas in the middle of working on this for a weekend, where my dad was, you know, a longtime choir director at St. Seraphim's and was retiring. And so he was sort of being honored. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, singing in the choir, just, and then standing there just thinking about, wow, like, this is so different. Like, I can't believe for my entire life, like, he's been this constant. And I know how important, you know, that ministry is to him, and how important, you know, the work that he's put in over the years. And it's, you know, at the time when he first started directing, like, this is before the internet, this is before there's a lot of resources in English, a lot of, you know, Orthodox texts were, you know, in Russian or Greek. And like, between him and Archbishop Dimitri, like, really were able, you know, to build out this repertoire. And the amount of work that he, like, put in sort of, you know, translating things and sort of, yeah, opening up this musical world that now, like, now you look online, you can find so many things, but it's crazy to think, like, none of that was really that accessible before. And just so, yeah, just, I think, I was just thinking about just, like, all the, you know, the work that he's put into this. And, you know, I know he's, like, a brilliant, you know, musician and composer and arranger, but I feel like some of that is, like, sort of untapped. Mm. And so I was just standing there, I was like, you know, Josh and I have been talking about this hymn that sort of occurs in a few spots. And we know it's to the word Señor ten piedad, which, Lord have mercy, in Spanish. And so I was just kind of like, you know, just standing there, and I was like, what if my dad and I, like, co-write this together? And he was, you know, floored when I asked him. And I think it was just something of, like, I know there's this thing that he can do that maybe he hasn't really like leaned into before. And I just thought, especially, just the nature of the film itself and how it really is a village, and it really is, the community rallying together to make the film, and like your family is involved. Both my parents make cameos in the film.
Yeah, I was gonna say
All
that.
these people that we're all really close to that really like, put in, whatever they could to make this come to life. And I think this was just like another moment where I was like, oh yeah, like this seems like it's right. And so yeah, and I think it's really, I think it makes it even more special, at least personally for me. So
Yeah, and then talking about the release of the single today, and then the LP comes out, the double vinyl record is being pressed as we speak. I got to do test pressing listenings. I did all the art with every talented person that I could find, and I'm so proud of this double LP vinyl record. And when you open it up, it's going to have an original poster that's created by a talented guy who's also talented in the choir. It's Patrick Reeves. He painted a new 11 by 17 poster that's inside. And then we have the sheet music of you and your dad. That song is in there. So it's like, it's official. I can't wait to hear that in a service in an Orthodox church or cathedral. It's just going to be, it's so wild because, they, in the film, it's the, I'm blanking out on the title, but it's the Holy, Holy, Holy that the Orthodox Saint Seraphim choir sings. It's the
Mercy piece.
holy, yes, the Mercy of Peace. And when I heard them, they were just warming up. They weren't planning on recording that when we had John Pettigo that day in the cathedral, and they were like, well, "Let's just warm up. Let's do, Mercy of Peace." And they're doing it, and me and Pettigo just look at each other like, "Oh my God!" It's because it's so shocking. It comes at you and it backs off, and it comes at you and it backs off. And I was like, "Oh man, that's how the movie starts after we've had this silence for so long." And then we have your score of the brother, and then it trickles down, and it's this, you get hit in the face with that. And we were in church the other day, and they sang that again. They sang it at Saint Seraphim, and there was probably six or seven people who like turned their heads, and they all look at me. I'm like, I didn't write that. That's just because they hadn't seen a screener of the movie. And it's just like, that's, I think, why I love creating and love making things, because, our lives are monotonous sometimes and they're busy, and we forget sometimes how talented all your friends all around you, things become normalized. And there's just those moments, it's like seeing your friends. It's like when I see my wife in the Polyphonic Spree on stage, and I see Tim on stage. It's just like, that's what you do. That's what, you do that. You and I turn around and people are singing along and they're jumping and dancing. It's like, oh wow, what a really cool experience. Because Tim is obviously in this film too. He's been in all my stuff that I've made, and just as an actor. And so it's really cool to see Tim on screen playing a character, and then hearing the Polyphonic Spree choir, and knowing my wife's in it, and Jennifer Jopes, and everybody who's in it, and then my production designer, Kristen Harden, is actually in the Polyphonic Spree choir, so she's like double dipping there. She gets to sing, and then make the sets beautiful. I mean, it's a family affair, and I'm so proud of you. And it's, we did This World Won't Break together, which I'm so proud of that movie, and I'm so proud of the way it sounds. And that's going to come out on double vinyl actually this year as well. And just to like, I feel like years ago we were just talking about things, and it'd be cool if we did this. And here we are, and the first single drops today of our second feature working together. And I just feel like it's starting to become like that relationship. I was always kind of like inspired, or like maybe jealous of like Paul Thomas Anderson and Johnny Greenwood, or there's just different people. And you're like, ah, oh, I wish I, because when you make a movie, it's, people don't realize this, how lonely it is. I mean, even for you as a composer, it's like, and you're not even on the set. You're the most distant person, you know, like you see everyone's faces, but they've never seen you. So you feel connected to them. Yeah. And, you know, and you make something with people for a couple weeks and then you have to make it into a movie. And I feel like we're getting to the point where it's our shorthand's getting better. And it's like, well, what if we did this? And it's weird because of how talented you are and your resume and all the things that you do. And I can play G and C on the guitar. And then me being like, well, I think it's not as funny. It needs to be more like dun, 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 or whatever. And I'm like, I sound like an idiot. I feel ridiculous. But you understand and you have such grace and patience with me. And then, you know, we were listening to Ascension this morning, the new single. I'm like, that's the whole entire movie. You know, you wrote that piece and I'm so thankful you did, because, you know, the film is in these pieces that are kind of drawn out with, you know, through dialogue and maybe just holding a note. And when you hear Ascension and you see that photo, it just feels like that's Atonta Per Cristo. That if you were to be able to describe what it feels like, because it's a slow paced film that I feel like moves like a train after the second act, and we get going on the third act. And I'm so excited for people to use it on their social media as something that is conveying what they're feeling on whatever post that they have. As much as like technology and Spotify and those things are annoying for the artist, and but the exposure that you can get and people from all across the world get to experience. And speaking of that, people probably don't know because it's in another language and I post things and it's in Romanian, but in November, the 1st of November, end of October, we're going to Romania where we're doing the European premiere and the Romanian premiere of El Tanto Per Cristo. And you're going, and you want to talk about what you're doing?
Yeah. So I'm super excited for that. Never been before. And yeah, screening the movie, and then we're also doing a concert of some of my music from, you know, El Tanto and from other projects as well. And so we've been, you know, coordinating with that right now and sort of, you know, making arrangements and changing some of the orchestration to fit, you know, the group that's playing. And then during the concert, I don't even know if you know this, they're going to have a live sand artist, and they're going to project her work on the on a screen, and she's going to be like drawing in the sand along to the music, sort of like scoring the music that's playing. And it's going to be really cool. Yeah.
See, this is when everything gets fun. You know, this is for anyone who's listening and wants to be a filmmaker. You know, in the end, when you get older or you've made projects, you really realize it's, you know, obviously you want your stuff to be recognized and you want people to like it. I mean, that's just human nature. But it's the in-between, right? It's getting to go to Romania. And this was never in my wheel. I never thought that they reached out to us, wanted to screen this. On Tarkovsky's son is going to be there. Showing a film that he made about his father of the making of Andrei Rublev. The timing is bizarre.
I just watched it.
it's so crazy. It's about iconography. It's about Andrei Rublev, and it's the making of, and he's going to be there, and they're going to, you know, match us up, and we're going to talk film, and I'm showing El Tanto Per Cristo surrounded by this place that has monasteries on every corner and chapels and cathedrals, and then you're playing and conducting your music in front of Romanian people while a lady does sand sculptures. This is, you can't make this kind of stuff up. And I really think it's all the stuff that all your hard work, all your determination, all your sacrifices. And I think that, you know, I'm excited to see how all this unfolds in life, how people respond to your music. We had just screened the film in Kentucky to some more artists and investors and people who have been a part of creating. We got some grants from Kentucky, and I showed the film, and, you know, it's 2 hours and you have credits. So it's almost like 2 hours and 14 minutes. And it's been a long day. And I walked up to the main guy and I said, hey, you need to go ahead. As the credits were rolling, I said, you need to go up and talk. And he goes, no. He goes, everyone's processing. Also, I want to hear this song. And it was the very end credit song. And everyone just sat there. And then I got up, we did a Q&A. It's supposed to be for 10 minutes. It ended up being an hour. Because people were processing in real time. And so many comments were on the score of the soundtrack. But it was, it's the kind of film that people will text you and call you the next day or 4 days because it's a, you know, they process it. And so the day after, every single person came up and goes, man, I've been thinking about the movie. I wish I could see it again today. Because I think it was a lot to take in. And they were all giving me their, what they thought the meaning of things were. And one of the guys said that he wishes he wanted more resolve with Ambrose. And he had a whole plot line, a whole story that I could put on the Blu-ray if I needed to about how to resolve some things. And I was like, oh, it's so awesome that people have a thought and they have emotion and it lives on forever. And the score is going to live on forever. And it's going to be on vinyl. The whole thing will be available October 6th, 2025, everywhere in the world. And leading up, we're going to have some more little treats along the way. But Michael, thanks for, was that?
Got a couple more singles.
Yeah, a couple more singles coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, is there anything you would say, like, this is a great conversation, you know, I think that younger composers or people who are talented musicians who want to get involved in something like this, what's just like one word of advice? I know that there's a thousand things that you could say, but what's one thing that a little takeaway that if somebody's wanting to do something like this, which is score a film, what would you say? What was the some steps?
I'd say first and foremost is just create and, you know, find, whether it's, you know, reaching out to someone in film school or reaching out to a company or some, like, just find some way to create and find some way to collaborate with other artists. Cause I think that's, at the end of the day, like, as composers, we are still filmmakers and we're telling the story through music, the medium music, but it's all, you know, going back to, you know, the film as a whole. And being able to understand that collaboration, understand that language. And that's something that you don't necessarily learn in music school. And that's something you just learn from experience and you learn from doing it over. And, you know, each director, each filmmaker has a different language as well and a different way that they process things and a different way they communicate. And so it's so much of, you know, this, you know, this journey is just like building that rapport. And I think that's kind of alluded to earlier. It's just something that over time you develop your own shorthand and you becomes this idea, hopefully this like sort of seamless, you know, process where it's takes a lot of trust and a lot of vulnerability and it, you know, just it comes from just doing it over and over again.
So. Yeah, for sure. It's just, I, you know, it's just do it and it's find people that you want to collaborate with because that's the tree of trust. And that's when you can let your guard down and let that subconscious take hold. And, you know, I'm excited for me and you for the next, you know, I'm sure you're practicing underwater sounds and
how to play the violin.
But there's, you know, what's wild is there's some other things that are popping up that I'm really excited about that I can tell you about later on that may be before that. So it's exciting. And I'm so proud of you and congratulations on the first single Ascension that you have created, which is out in the world today. And more will be trickling and holding hands with it as we walk into October 6th. And everyone gets to see it and own it and listen to it and watch it.
And I'm excited for the LA screening December.
Yes. So I cannot wait. That's like a dream. It's like we're getting to play in places. You know, like the John F. Kennedy Center. We're going to be playing at the John F. Kennedy Center. We're playing in these places that I've heard about growing up. And I'm really excited because a lot of these theaters are very excited. The Texas Theater is so excited. These people in Memphis at the Malco are so excited. And the street team is so excited. And I know that this song today is really going to get everybody's wheels turning, because if you think about it, no one's seen the movie yet.
Yeah.
Just a few of us. And so it's like a kid going off to college. You're like, all right. And they go off to college. That's what our movie is going to be doing. So
yeah, and I like teased just that one shot, and you're like, yeah, now you have to think like, what is this going to be? So
yeah, a lot of people have commented. They're just like, oh my goodness, this shot, this is an amazing shot. And I'm like, oh, just wait. Hutch Crane did such a phenomenal job. And I was, like I said, I watched it last weekend. And what's bizarre to me is I get more excited each time I watch it. You know, a lot of my stuff, it's hard to go back and watch things. For some reason, this film, I feel like I'm finding out new stuff every single day, and I've lived with it for 2 years. But yeah, well, Michael, thank you for waking up early with us today, and congratulations. I'm excited to see what everybody says today.
Thanks, Josh. You too. I can't wait to, you know, share it with the world. We're there.
ETPC.
Yeah.
All right. I'll see you later. Bye.
Thanks.